My mother-in-law is 90 years old. And up until a couple of years ago, she could still do the splits. And she never fails to remind me just how very important your health is. Oh, Emily, she says, your health. Oh, it's your health. It's the most important thing. Of course, she's got a real thick Hungarian accent to go along with that. It sounds better when she says it. Being a political refugee, she also says education is the most important thing. It's the one thing they can't take away from you, she says. But this segment's on healthcare. It all started last summer during the primary season when I was listening to a forum between Dimitri Sheen and Elise Galvin, and they both expressed health care issue as a human right. I was taken by that. If it was a human right, I wondered, then why were so many people struggling to get adequate care, and why were so many people unhealthy? That led me to Tiana Lee and our two very different perspectives on healthcare in the Valley, hers as a 20-year-old and me, well, not so much. And we learned a lot. For one thing, healthcare, human right or not, is a messy, complicated topic. Not one to fit neatly into a 30-minute radio segment, that was for sure. Now, the primary season, long gone, and the actual campaign season is ending with days, even hours. And it's a close race, and anybody's guess for the state's lead dog position for governor. Well, Tiana is back at school in Vermont, but I invited Senators Mike Dunleavy and Mark Begich, who are running toward a close finish, to wrap up our questions on healthcare in Alaska. Senator Begich got right back to me and agreed to a phone interview, but I did not hear back from Senator Dunleavy or his running mate, Kevin Meyer. So while today we don't hear directly from Senator Dunleavy personally, there is enough on record to compare the two frontrunners on their views regarding healthcare in Alaska. I wanted to know what the senators felt about healthcare and how they would prioritize this monster of a topic and what legacy they would hope to leave us with at the end of their term should they win. So my first question was all about priorities. Senator, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know it must just be a whirlwind these last few days.
It is. It's busy and traveling all over the state.
I just can't imagine, so I really do appreciate this. Arguably, Alaska has the highest health care costs in the country. But the conversation about health care is complicated. And the reasons for this enormous cost care is equally complicated. And that I learned very well over my work this summer. I have a list of 10 priority issues affecting quality of care and cost of care in Alaska. And I'm going to read them to you, and then I'm going to ask you to prioritize your top three healthcare issues. All right?
Okay.
Medicare expansion for Alaska. The continuation of reinsurance that Governor Bill Walker started. The availability of affordable insurance for all Alaskans. Containing the cost of healthcare for the increasing senior population. The overall cost of prescription drugs. Looking at the success of the Native healthcare system and perhaps replicating it. The University of Alaska medical training and programs, including building a school of medicine. Access to additional health care, for instance, behavioral, dental, and or alternative. The increased availability of primary care providers in the state. And finally, access to healthy communities, transportation, access to healthy food, activities, housing, that type of thing. So, Senator, how would you prioritize your top three health care issues?
Well, the challenge with all those, if you say here's the one, two, three you're going to do, that's probably not the most realistic approach because they're all more connected, and I believe you can do several of these simultaneously. But when you look at them, what I would call the easy ones that would not be a problem is, you know, making sure the reinsurance program continues. That's in my view, a piece of cake, and making sure it doesn't go away, supporting what the governor has done on that. Prescription drugs, I believe there's a simple solution to that, at least to start, and that is allowing importation from Canada, as Connecticut has done, as that governor has done. I think are both what I would call kind of the easy, low-hanging fruit in a lot of ways. But then when you look at the bigger issues, I think you have to have UA training in school of medicine, because we have to train our own in order to create a stable workforce and an increasing workforce. I think replicating the native Alaska Native healthcare system has huge opportunities for us within our own ability to deliver care as Medicaid and others being delivered. Those are two, in my view, is kind of an underlining, I don't know if I would call it a prioritization, but I think we do should use that as a basis. And then if I was to say, okay, what's the big challenges that are going to take more time to figure out, and that is affordability, because that should be an end result of what you're working on, and two, increasing care. Again, it's an end result, because if you figure out a better delivery system, you ensure you have good school training and individuals being trained, then you're going to increase the amount of people providing care. But the one I hear most about is behavioral health, substance abuse, addiction services. These are sometimes considered optional reimbursements with Medicaid and other programs that the state government operates, and then in some cases the federal government reimburses for. Those are core services, in my view. We have a crisis in this state when it comes to behavioral health, mental health services. And if we don't address this, it's going to have a multiplier effect. It already is showing we do. And I think in a lot of ways, one of our challenges there goes back to, again, training and a workforce ready to work in those fields. So I know it's not the simple answer you're looking for, because I don't think you can say, here's three things, that's it, because they're all interconnected. And, you know, when you mentioned the senior cost control, well, that's affordability. Those two, to me, are the same. Because if you get affordability across the system, you're going to also improve affordability for seniors. And so that's how I would look at this. And there's some that, again, are overriding in a lot of ways. And again, how the Native healthcare system operates, the Alaska Native healthcare system operates, is a very good model to have underpinning everything you work on when it comes to delivering healthcare throughout Alaska, private and public.
Without Senator Dunleavy here in person, it's difficult to really know what he would answer in terms of prioritizing the medical issues facing Alaskans and their healthcare. But if we dig deep into previous interviews and articles, we can get a feel for Senator Dunleavy's positions so that we can have some comparison when we go to the polls. Senator Dunleavy has been explicit in his desire to restore trust in government. He's been more implicit in exactly how he would do that. His statements regarding Medicaid expansion are more clear. He expressed dismay at the executive order that Governor Walker put in place expanding Medicaid across Alaska. Then in August 2018, he told Bloomberg Law that his campaign certainly isn't running on the notion that Medicaid expansion ought to just be rolled back. He believed that we have the program and we need to do the best we can to go forward in a constructive manner. His concern was that the program is expected to cost the state $691 million in 2019 and providing coverage to 225,000 people, nearly one in every three Alaskans. Dunleavy says that it's really the sheer number of people eligible for Medicaid in Alaska that should be more alarming than the cost of the program to the state overall. On KTUU in August as well, he wrote in, "My focus as governor will be on controlling the costs of health care and health insurance. I will not define success based on growing number of people who are dependent on government, but rather on growing the number of people who have no need for government assistance in meeting their health care needs." And in October, on radio station KSDP in Dillingham, in an answer regarding the cutting of the budget and how his proposed budget cuts might affect rural communities, Dunleavy responded that he felt some management issues with health and social services must be addressed, and he mentioned the Alaska's balance due of $100 to $160 million in overpayment of Medicaid payments to providers that Alaska has to pay back or pay a penalty to the federal government. He was very concerned about that, and he also mentioned consolidating school districts' insurance policies into a voluntary pool might be an answer, maybe even to include borough and municipality employees, that could save the state $100 to $150 million. And that, in my research, is about as specific as I can get with what Dunleavy would propose and what might be his priorities. But let's back up a little bit. What exactly is this Medicaid expansion that the two senators keep talking about? In 2014, under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government expanded Medicaid payments to all states. Alaska refused to accept it. Governor Walker insisted that we should expand Medicaid, and the Republican-controlled legislature said no. The legislators said the price of oil was too low to cover any increased cost through the Medicaid expansion. Governor Walker cited the tens of thousands of Alaskans who were caught in the gap with the Affordable Care Act of the non-elderly that no longer could afford insurance. So he signed an executive order and expanded Medicaid, and the fight was on. By 2018, 44,000 more Alaskans were covered under Alaska's Medicaid expansion, and the uninsured level dropped to only 13% of Alaskans without insurance. Alaskans seem pretty clear on this issue, even if our candidates seem to be slightly opposed to each other. Last year, Public Opinion Strategies did a poll, and they found that the majority of Alaskans favored the state's Medicaid program. In their poll, they found that 56% viewed it favorably, with a neutral of 18%. There was only a small percentage of voters unfavorable, 19% of the program in the state. 76% of Alaskans wanted funding increased or to remain the same, and only 17% wanted to decrease funding for the Medicaid program. What's more interesting, 60% of all Alaskans polled knew someone in their immediate family or friends that were covered on Medicaid. So with those numbers, it's easy to see why both candidates say they have no intention of reducing Medicaid. They simply want to see how it's managed. But with Mr. Begich on the line, I dug a little deeper. I'd like to know a little bit more about what he was talking about. If I understand you, you took the top three healthcare issues and you broke it into the easy quick fixes, the ones that you, the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, the ones that are challenging but most important foundationally, and then these biggest challenges, ending with the loudest one with behavioral health and what to do with addiction and substance abuse. And I'd like you to tell me a little bit more your thoughts about increasing care and this better delivery system.
Sure. And you just so you know, your summary was right on. If you could say it's three categories and you did it, and I appreciate that. So, for example, there are over 200,000 people that are on Medicaid in Alaska. Medicaid, which the state operates, $800 million expense to the state. We're fortunate that 90% of a portion of Medicaid is reimbursed by the federal government, so we appreciate that. But it's a big driver to the market, but yet, couple things that I believe are incredible opportunities to create better delivery systems than that. First, 75% of the care in Medicaid is preventable. So we need to really shape up a new prevention program within Medicaid. It won't pay off in the first year. It will pay off over the longer term. But if you could save 5% in the Medicaid program through more efficient use of preventive services, which of course means healthier outcomes, you could save easily, I believe, $40 million or more per year. Then the other one, which I think is outstanding here when you read it, read the data, and that is 20 to 30% of the cost of Medicaid is paperwork. And we know this, 95% of the Medicaid cost for programs, for all the services, all the things you go for, procedures and so forth, are covered by Medicaid. Even after you go through a process of denials and you go through appeals, basically 95% of the services for Medicaid patients are covered. But we spend 20 to 30% of the cost trying to make sure that no one's doing anything wrong, which is really the remaining 5%. So what I'd like to do is say, look, I'll use a category, general practitioners. I'm going to go hire a GP. I don't care if they work for a hospital, a clinic, their own private practice. We're going to use Medicaid funds, and we're going to say we're going to pay you $250,000 a year plus benefits, and you're going to have to take all Medicaid patients that come through your door. And in exchange, we will no longer require you to do all the paperwork. If they are Medicaid eligible, then you provide the services because you're going to anyway, and we're going to pay you anyway 95% of the cost. So instead of doing the paper shuffle and trying to figure out if the left arm we coded right for or was the right arm we coded right for, forget all that. Because what we're going to judge you on is not how many pieces of paper you sent us, but we're going to judge you on how did that person come out of the system? Are they healthier? Are they better? Have you moved them in the right track? That alone, when we spend $800 million a year on Medicaid, as I said, around 30% of the cost is paperwork. Let's just assume you could save 10%. It's $80 million. You get a more efficient system. You get people who get care. You create access. And now we're using our market to push the pricing and kind of trying to keep it more affordable and creating better access. So that's how I would do it.
Increasing the better delivery system, and you looked specifically at Medicaid and the reimbursement of Medicaid, and that includes this thorny issue of the reimbursement of Medicaid. And so you're saying if we look at the redundancy in paperwork, trim that down, we can save 20 to 30% and guarantee our doctors that they won't have to do that redundancy of paperwork. They're going to get reimbursed. Doctors take more patients. They get better care. And so the ball is rolling that way. Do I understand you right?
That's right. I'd say one caveat. It's not going to be about reimbursement. It is you walk in the door, you show them your card, you're Medicaid eligible, whatever the illness is that needs to be dealt with, you deal with it. And you don't send us a bill to the state of Alaska for Medicaid. You're getting paid by us to care for that individual. But on top of that, if you're taking all the Medicaid patients, and let's say you got 20% more time available, well, here's what we'd love you to do with that. Help private insurers and those folks, because now they're not worried about the cost of their business. They can actually do those services for you at a better pricing and reduced. Because the way it works now is, doctors can only take a certain amount of Medicaid patients because they lose money on them because they have to pay their overhead, their doctor pay, all that. And so when they do that, then the rest of the insured or private pay pick up the slack. But now if you're saying, look, we're going to give you the $250 that you would have earned and actually better. I actually had one doctor say to me, that'd be three times what I make today. And I said, yeah, but what would that do? He says, I'd love it because now I get to practice delivering medicine. And then if they have, say, 80% of their day or 70% of their day is Medicaid patients, they got another 30% of their time available for, let's say, myself, who has private insurance, I come in, and they might be able to say, well, you know, that procedure we used to charge $250 so we could cover the loss that we would have on Medicaid. We don't have to do that anymore. We can charge you less. So it can have a market force that could make a difference. We got to use this power of 200,000 people that we manage their health care as a state of Alaska that we pay for in a way that can deliver better outcomes and change the market conditions.
Running for public office is a sacrifice. It's a risk. You sacrifice your time, your money. You risk your privacy. You lose out on a lot of other family and friend commitments. And that's why it's called service. Once elected, you are a public servant. I think those people with this drive to run for public office must have an unshakable desire to make a difference and serve for the greater good. And despite my better sense, I hold on to that perspective. So my final question for Senator Begich on the phone was more akin to what would he want his legacy to be if he was elected? I want to do a little crystal ball activity. Look in your crystal ball and see that you have been elected governor of Alaska, and there's ticker tape and champagne and everybody's having a good time. And then your four-year term is over, and the legislature was surprisingly cooperative with all of your agenda. All went really well. Even oil stayed around $70 a barrel. Life is really good for you. But simply said, and more importantly, in this crystal ball, how have your priorities on health care worked for us?
Well, I think for the 20-year-old, depending if she is a recipient and a or someone who would like to be in health care, two things could happen. First off, better access. So if she wanted to actually work in the health care industry, Alaska's university system has easier access instead of a 2-year wait period, for example, to just get into the nursing school, that she would have access, that others would have access, that she could do her education right here in Alaska in order to maintain an ability to work in the healthcare arena. But also as a recipient, that she has better access and better pricing if she's self-insured. Maybe she's a young person going to school and she's on Medicaid because that's the insurance program she has, that they will have a better access as she can get to her doctor without having to worry about them telling her, I'm sorry, we've reached our capacity of Medicaid patients, we can't take you. I don't want that to be happening, and we might have a pretty innovative approach around that. In regards to yourself, you know, one of the biggest issues, again, is access. One of the biggest payers in health care for seniors is Medicaid, especially for senior care, senior living, senior assisted living. And as you're moving through your age, making sure you have quality care in those arenas that Medicaid can afford it, but also you have a doctor that isn't worried about billable time. They're more worried about making sure you have better care and working with you. Instead of spending 5 minutes with you, they're spending more time with you to understand your whole needs in health care. And lastly, depending on the young person who might maybe have some issues that are addictions or behavioral health issues, that they know they have access and availability of those services in the state. And on the flip side, for a senior who, as time progresses, maybe they have issues that they need to make sure that they have that care that's no longer a secondary care, but it is right up there with everything else, so the ability to access it is better. And at the end of the day, in the healthcare arena, you're talking to an Alaskan who's lived or worked or been most of their life or born in Alaska. That's your doctor, your nurse, your pharmacist. I think that is a goal that I would have. 4 years would be tough, but I think if you set the goal, anything is possible.
It's nothing but odd to hold a radio interview with two candidates when one candidate isn't there. And as much as we can assume or gather information from past articles interviewed with Senator Dunleavy, I'm still left with some questions. The October poll on the midterm elections with NBC News and the Wall Street Journal offers me a new idea. While healthcare is ranked as the second most important overall issue on the midterms, there's a stark difference between party lines. 44% of Democrats believe it's a top issue. 31% of independent voters think it's a top issue. And 17% of the GOP feel it's a top issue. Maybe that's why Senator Dunleavy sees real no need to be specific on his Medicaid expansion or health care plans. His voter base doesn't really care. I don't know. I have no crystal ball for that one. But on November 7th, after the elections, people will still be looking for affordable health care, access to affordable health care, and healthy communities. Flu seasons will still come and go. So my 90-year-old mother-in-law, she has a point. Our health, it's really important. It's the only thing that we have. That and education, which they can never take away from us. But that's for another day. Right now, I hope this information on healthcare in Alaska and where your candidate stands gives you some information when you hit the voting polls on November 6th. Remember to vote. Your health may just depend on it.